that those who surrender to him, those are the ones that can get free very easily, otherwise can't. Then in text 15, Krishna now goes on to describe the four kinds of people who don't surrender to him. So that things are progressing very logically. And there's a really long purport to this verse. So Prabhupada describes the four kinds. So let's do the Sanskrit. Do take 15 words.
She's probably on her way back from Hawaii.
Okay, text 15. Namam duskriti no muda.
Namam duskriti no muda.
Prapadyante naradhama.
Prapadyante naradhama.
Mayaya paritjnana.
Mayaya paritjnana.
Asuram bhava ashrita.
Asuram bhava ashrita.
Duskritina, miscreants, muta, foolish, prapadyante, surrender, nara, dhamma, lowest among mankind, mayaya, by the illusory energy, aparita, stolen, jnana, knowledge, asuram, demon, bhav, nature, asrita, accepting. Those miscreants who are grossly foolish, who are lowest among mankind, whose knowledge is stolen by illusion, and to partake of the atheistic nature of demons, do not surrender to me. Well, let's read it together. Those miscreants who are grossly foolish,
who are lowest among mankind, whose knowledge is stolen by illusion, and who partake of the atheistic nature of demons, do not surrender unto me.
Okay. So these four are called Duskritina. Duskritina. If you look ahead to text 16, where he describes four kinds of people who do surrender, or do approach him, they're called Sukritina. So Duskritina, Sukritina. Bad doers and good doers. I'll put it literally. Dursh means bad and su means good. Kriti means one who does things. Duskritina and sukritina. But Duskritina will be explained later on in the purport. So, four kinds. These ill doers, miscreants. Muda, Naratma, Mayaya Vaktajnana and Asuram Bhav Asrita. There's a rogues gallery here. So, purport. It is said in Bhagavad Gita that simply by surrendering oneself unto the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality, one can surmount the stringent laws of material nature. And where is it said? Yeah. And in the Bhagavad Gita, that simply by surrendering oneself into the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality, Krishna, one can surmount the stringent laws of material nature. Where is that stated?
14.
Yeah, I just read it. Great. I'm glad you're here. At this point, a question arises. How is it that educated philosophers, scientists, businessmen, administrators, and all the leaders of ordinary men do not surrender to the lotus feet of Sri Krishna, the all-powerful personality of Godhead? Mukti, or liberation, from the laws of material nature is sought by the leaders of mankind in different ways in the great plan and perseverance for a great many years and births. But if that liberation is possible by simply surrendering unto the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then why don't these intelligent and hard-working leaders adopt this simple method? So that's the doubt. If it's so easy and simple, why haven't all these big scientists, philosophers, etc. done it? The Gita answers this question very frankly. Those really learned leaders of society, like Brahma, Shiva, Kapila, the Kumaras, Manu, Vyasa, Devala, Vasita, Janaka, Prahlad, Pali, and later on Vandvacharya, Ramanujacharya, Sri Chaitanya, and many others, who are faithful philosophers, politicians, educators, scientists, etc., surrender to the lotus feet of the Supreme Person, the all-powerful authority. Those who are not actually philosophers, scientists, educators, administrators, etc., but impose themselves as such for material gain, do not accept the plan or the path of the Supreme Lord. They have no idea of God. They simply manufacture their own worldly plans and consequently complicate the problems of material existence in their vain attempt to solve it. Because material energy, nature, is so powerful, it can resist the unauthorized plans of the atheists and baffle the knowledge of planning commissions. They simply complicate the problems of material existence in their vain attempts to solve it. That's the effort. You can think of many examples to solve the problem of disease. So many complications have arisen, such as so many strains of microbes that have become resistant to practically all kinds of drugs taken to do them. And you know, give your friend Rachel Carson and these people, you can see, you know, complications increase. Well, anyway, what he's saying here is this verse answers this question, that these people who appear to be great people in society are actually duskritina, because they haven't surrendered to Krishna. Whatever they do, even though it be done with great intelligence, dispatch, endeavor, cleverness, cunning, effort, assiduity, whatever, is bad. And he'll explain this in the next paragraph. So the answer is, why don't intelligent people surrender to Krishna? The answer is, if they don't surrender, they're not intelligent. Genuinely intelligent people do surrender.
Is that also...
You want to make a distinction between material intelligence and spiritual intelligence?
No, well, intelligence is intelligence. What is described in this verse is maya paritajana. They may be very bright, but their intelligence becomes stolen by the illusory energy. Ultimately, that's stupid. Ultimately, anyone who doesn't surrender to Krishna cannot be considered intelligent.
But at the same time, they have...
Man, it doesn't count for anything. That doesn't count for anything. It's useless.
Well, my conception is that there's basically two kinds of intelligence.
Now, there's only one kind of intelligence.
The understanding.
That means there's two truths. Is it the material truth and the spiritual truth, right? Someone who's materially... I know a lot of clever people, for example, that are considered to be materially intelligent because they can perform some material task very well. But if you actually look at the conduct of their lives, leaving aside even spiritual consideration, it's stupid. And you know, it's just the idea of what you actually consider intelligent. You know, Like, for example, I know big scientists who work very, very hard with great endeavor and effort and everything, making weapons of mass destruction. Now, you can say just on a material basis that for that reason they're not very bright.
But on the other hand, you can say that many scientists working for medicine are very,
well, then that's brighter. But then because they don't surrender to Krishna, they're not really the brightest of all.
You say someone's less intelligent simply because they haven't surrendered to Krishna.
That's what we're saying.
I think we have to really come down to what is intelligence.
Yeah, what is intelligence? Bhagavad Gita is in the platform of intelligence. You see, you think, Gary, you think that, you know, having a certain number on the Stanford-Binet scale is intelligence. But that's a concoction to make them feel better about themselves.
No, I'm not saying that. I'd say someone can be materially rather less intelligent, but spiritually, because they surrender to Krishna, they have their eyes. Whereas someone may be materially very high on the Stanford-Binet scale. But
see, Stanford-Binet scale doesn't measure intelligence.
No.
It measures your ability to do a certain kind of test, which we call intelligence. So actual intelligence is given here by one surrendering to Krishna. And then you become very intelligent because you have all the brain power available to you by Super Soul. I don't really know how much I really want to accept the double standard. Just good. Your problem is that you know somebody dumb who surrendered to Krishna. When I say, I don't accept that person is dumb.
No, I'm not saying they're dumb either, but someone from a material standpoint.
What we're trying to say, the material standpoint is wrong. What is the material standpoint, that is, which judges everything without taking God into account. Is that to be given, you know, some consideration? No. The material standpoint is the wrong standpoint. That's what this whole thing is talking about here. That duskritina.
Okay, but say we see many intelligent devotees. Even we say sometimes they're overly intelligent, they just fall away.
Well, that's just an expression of meaning they've lost their intelligence. Anyway, I don't like to give this. I'm in the mood of this verse right now. What is intelligence? Buddhi. Right. And the universities are not on the platform of intelligence, they're on the platform of the mind. And the exercise of mental skill is not considered by those learned in Vedic knowledge to be intelligence. Intelligence is something higher. Those who have no intelligence cannot understand what intelligence is. But it is the ability, ultimately to be able to discriminate matter from spirit and to concentrate the mind, great determination on the Supreme Personality of Godhead and surrender to Him. What the materialists call an act of faith and can't really deal with it because to them it's just faith is really the discrimination of intelligence. You see, because when you come right down to it, anybody, everybody is moving on an act of faith. A person who says, I don't believe in faith, I don't accept reason, and is convinced that reason is right, has committed an act of faith. And that person has a faith. So if you look it down to everybody, they've got their little worldview, their world system, and right down at the bottom is something that they placed everything. There's some premise. And then if you get down to those things, how do you discriminate between those which are right and which are wrong? You have to choose between one or the other. Is it just blind faith or blind surrender? No, it's a discrimination of intelligence. Oh, but how does that work? How do we choose? That we have to read the Bhagavad Gita, which is about that, which tells us how to surrender to the absolute truth of Krishna. to know intelligence, you have to develop your own intelligence. That's what I mean by intelligence. So someone who hasn't surrendered to Krishna is deficient in intelligence, which is a form direction of the Supersoul.
I think this is an extremely important point, because even in our society, we wonder how come some people are so smart that they go away from devotional service. Just as there's some people who are so smart, but they
I've never considered those people to be very bright.
Me either, you know. But there's a big misconception.
Yeah, just because they can talk fast and bewilder everybody. It doesn't mean they're smart or intelligent. Intelligence is a much deeper thing than the superficial exercise of mental agility. The atheistic plan makers are described herein by the word duskritina, or miscreants. Kriti means one who has performed meritorious work. Now get that, the word kriti means one has performed meritorious work. The atheistic plan maker is sometimes very intelligent. This is a Brahmana's super sense. And meritorious also, because any gigantic plan, good or bad, must take intelligence to execute. But because the atheist brain is improperly utilized in opposing the plan of the Supreme Lord, the atheistic plan maker is called duskriti, which indicates that his intelligence and efforts are misdirected. So in that sense, you can say again, you want to do all this, you want to build a 747, you want to make cruise missiles, it requires that in a big plan. So there's some kriti, that's meritorious work. But because it is, as he said, it's improperly utilized in opposing the plan of the Lord, therefore duskriti. It really took a lot of enterprise, for example, a big organization, a great brain, to murder 6,000 Jews, 6 million Jews. And that's a huge number. That's a big thing, a lot of effort and everything. But ultimately, it wasn't so bright an idea. So basically, they're all discontinuing, and their intelligence and efforts are misdirected. In the Gita, it is clearly mentioned that material energy works fully under the direction of the Supreme Lord. It has no independent authority. It works as the shadow moves in accordance with the movement of the object. But still, material energy is very powerful. And the atheist, due to his godless temperament, cannot know how it works, nor can he know the plan of the Supreme Lord. Under illusion and the modes of passion and ignorance, all his plans are baffled, as in the case of Hiranyakashipu and Ravana, whose plans were smashed to dust, although they were both materially learned as scientists, philosophers, administrators, and educators. These duskritinas, or miscreants, are of 4 different patterns, as outlined below. So that's your overly intelligent, like Ravana. He had to challenge Ramachandra, which was not very bright and long enough to make mistakes. But these are duskritina. Any questions so far? Before?
distinction. And another thing is that this knowledge being stolen by illusion, that it says that when one is in the mode of goodness, then one is in knowledge. So these men, that's before one can actually attain real knowledge. So these men who are in the lower modes, then I don't know how to express it, but they've developed some skills. But ultimately, that right there from the explanation of Bhagavad Gita explains that they haven't come to the platform yet of knowledge. It explains that that's...
Well, it's not those that do, then their knowledge gets stolen. Others who don't, they're like mudhas. Mudhas, I mentioned, is people who not even have any knowledge to be stolen. There's a team of bad doers. Mudhas, I mean, people who will discuss mudhas. One, the mudhas are those who are grossly foolish, like hard-working beasts of burden. They want to enjoy the fruits of their labor by themselves, and so do not want to part with them, the fruits of their labor, for the Supreme. The typical example of the beast of burden is the ass. This humble beast is made to work very hard by his master. The ass does not really know for whom he works so hard day and night. He remains satisfied by filling his stomach with a bundle of grass, sleeping for a while under the fear of being beaten by his master, and satisfying his sex appetite at the risk of being repeatedly kicked by the opposite party. The ass sings poetry and philosophy sometimes, but this braying sound only disturbs others. This is the position of the foolish fruitive worker who does not know for whom he should work, who does not know that karma, action, is meant for yajna, sacrifice. So the mudras are compared to asses, this beast of burden. They don't know who they work for, they don't know why they're working, but every day they do it. They actually are very attached to what fruits they get, although it's hardly anything at all. But still, they're intensely into it. A very small paycheck. A watch at the end of 30 years. And they're proud. Proud of it. Somebody's taken all their work very hard, given their life for the company. But that's... And their pride is that they slugged it out. For 30 years they punched in and punched out. It's very sad. Most often those who work very hard day and night to clear the burden of self-created duties say that they have no time to hear of the immortality of a living being. To such mudas, material gains, which are destructible, are lives all in all, despite the fact that the mudas enjoy only a very small fraction of the fruit of labor. Of course, the muda here is the typical worker, and the capitalist is getting, getting the big return. Sometimes they spend sleepless days and nights for fruitive gain, and although they may have ulcers or indigestion, they are satisfied with practically no food. They are simply absorbed in working hard day and night for the benefit of illusory masters. Ignorant of their real master, the foolish workers waste their valuable time serving men. Unfortunately, they never surrender to the Supreme Master of all masters, nor ever take time to hear of him from the proper sources. The swine who eat the night soil, you know what night soil is? You know anymore. Stool. Also called night soil. The swine who eat the night soil do not care to accept sweetmeats made of sugar and ghee. Similarly, the foolish worker will untiringly continue to hear of the sense enjoyable tidings of the flickering mundane world, but will have very little time to hear about the eternal living force that moves the material world. So that's the picture of the Buddha. I think that's many questions about this well-known personality type, clearing the burden of self-created duties. They moonlight, Buddha's moonlight. They work very, very hard. They have to have two jobs. And they never get to enjoy. They work very hard, and yet they're fruit of work. They're always working too hard ever to enjoy the fruits. And all they can think is they're proud of having worked so hard. And they brag about how they never get any time off.
The Protestant work ethic almost seems to fall
into this category. Yes, it very encourages that. Just the thing about the Protestant work ethic was how notably ascetic everybody was, working hard for money like crazy, but nobody actually even enjoying much.
I was wondering whether that, it looks like someone's working really hard, and they're not really inquisitive about the absolute truth, but they are taking care of their family.
Mm-hmm.
If that isn't, and they're not able to really enjoy it for themselves, that wouldn't elevate them.
Well, that's a little critique, so that's the good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the bad thing is that they have no time. They have no time to work. They're very interesting people. Once in a while, you get a real Buddha who becomes real interested in devotional service. But it's interesting to see, actually. They actually, people that want to go to time, they have no time, they're always in anxiety. Because, any time they spend off to come to the temple or the group, Krishna consciousness, the church, it freaks them out. Most Buddhas I notice that they're always in anxiety. They're like this, anytime they're not actually working, it makes them very nervous not to be working. They can't enjoy vacations either, because they're very nervous. So, but it's still food to eat, even though you're supporting your family. It's just that you've identified now with your family and yourself, and that should be an achievement. In the Kali Yuga, it's considered to be a great support of family. It's true, and it's the local heroism that somebody actually does this. And of course, it's really highly extolled since then. People don't even do that. They're worse than Buddhas. Anyway, this is the Buddha. But they really are not interested in spiritual life at all. They just don't see them. You can't hear.
You know what's funny? When we read this and you hear this explanation, I mean, it makes it look like that what we've done all our life, or the people that we care about, or the friends, and things like that, it makes it look like that we're calling them, the Bhagavad Gita is calling them the lowest of mankind. But I found that after a while, that if you keep reading this, you'll begin to believe it and agree that it's true, that we can kind of see our position, you know, we can see how fortunate we are.
I mean, we're hearing about four kinds of people, Krishna says, who will never surrender to him. I mean, these are really people who are really cut off. That means, Devante, who preach Krishna consciousness, and other literature. These are the people that will just never, never consider. They do not surrender unto me, he says. These are the four. They can cross beyond it. So they never surrender. Prabhupada said in the purport, they never surrender.
Can't be innocent.
Innocent and never surrender? Innocent,
well,
means
innocent meaning that they can be preached.
Oh, they're innocent people who act like this, but you get a real hardcore.
Don't sometimes catastrophes break through?
Yeah, well that's the program of material nature. You get hit with enough catastrophes. Since material life is one catastrophe after another, you will finally break through. So that can happen.
But this is the general rule for people who don't surrender to Krishna.
But the
Duskritina, you see, I mean, there's something like meritorious in the guy who's lugging it out for 30 years. He's reliable. Buddhas are reliable people. So the skriti is some meritorious work, but again, because of that meritorious work, it cuts them off completely from Krishna. Duskriti. And their intelligence, out of courtesy, we'll call it intelligence. Their intelligence is useless.
She was saying about people, about the different complexities that, you know, bring them to hard times that could bring them to something good. Prabhupada said in the purport in the second chapter that life is full of perplexities, and these perplexities behoove one to find a spiritual master. So that would mean that they would come to the other side. If one is actually goes through all these calamities and these perplexities, and he comes to make the positive, then he's on the good side, one of the four pious men. Making the difference between them being innocent, like they were talking about earlier, or not.
Let's go on to the Naradana. Another class of duskriti or miscreant is called the Naradama. It's Naradama, or the lowest of mankind. Nara means human being, and Adama means the lowest. Out of the 8,400,000 different species of living beings, there are 400,000 human species. Out of these, there are numerous lower forms of human life that are mostly uncivilized. You notice that the word species is not used in the same sense as modern science uses it. It's just a word that means category. So, numerous lower forms of human life, that are mostly uncivilized. The civilized human beings are those who have regulative principles of social, political, and religious life. Those who are socially and politically developed, but who have no religious principles, must be considered Naradamas. So there's the definition. They are socially and politically developed, so they're not aboriginal people. But they have no spiritual life. Therefore, they waste the opportunity of civilized human life. Nor is religion without God religion. There are various types of those. Because the purpose of following religious principles is to know the supreme truth, man's relation with him. In the Gita, the personality of Godhead clearly states that there is no authority above him, and he is the supreme truth. The civilized form of human life is meant for man's reviving the lost consciousness of his eternal relation with the supreme truth, the personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, who is all-powerful. Whoever loses this chance is classified as a Naradama. We get information from revealed scriptures that when the baby is in the mother's womb, an extremely uncomfortable situation, he prays to God for deliverance and promises to worship him alone as soon as he gets out. To pray to God when he is in difficulty is a natural instinct in every living being because he is eternally related with God. But after his deliverance, the child forgets the difficulties of birth and forgets his deliverer also being influenced by Maya, the illusory energy. It is the duty of the guardians of children to revive the divine consciousness dormant in them. The 10 processes of reformatory ceremonies, as enjoined in the Manu Smriti, which is the guide to religious principles, are meant for reviving God consciousness in the system of Varnashram. However, no process is strictly followed now in any part of the world.
And therefore, 99.9% of the population is Narada. They're civilized, but they don't follow the reformatory processes for reviving God consciousness. When the whole population becomes Naradama, naturally all their so-called education is made null and void by the all-powerful energy of physical nature. According to the standard of the Gita, a learned man is he who sees on equal terms the learned Brahmana, the dog, the cow, the elephant, and the dog-eater. This is the vision of a true devotee. Sri Nityananda Prabhu was the incarnation of Godhead as divine master, delivered the typical Naradamas, the brothers Jagai and Madai, and showed how the mercy of a real devotee is bestowed upon the lowest of mankind. So the Naradama, who is condemned by the personality of Godhead, can again revive his spiritual consciousness only by the mercy of a devotee. So there, Krishna says they never surrender. But Prabhupada is saying here, by the example of Nityananda, we can see that by the mercy of a devotee, even these Naradama. Otherwise, it would be preached to 99.9% of the population is Naradama, those who have not taken advantage of the civilized form of life. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in propagating the Bhagavad Dharma, or activities of the devotees, has recommended that people submissively hear the message of the personality of Godhead. The essence of this message is Bhagavad Gita. The lowest amongst human beings can be delivered by the submissive hearing process only. But unfortunately, they even refuse to give an oral reception to these messages, and what to speak of surrendering to the will of the Supreme Lord. Naradamas, or the lowest of mankind, will fully neglect the prime duty of human beings. So any questions about Naradamas? This would be a good play to put on, actually. We have four guys. Amuda, Naradama.
So, it seems like Amudas are a category of Naradamas, right?
Yeah, they tend to be. And it would seem that if you're a Naradama and on top of that Amuda, you're going to have more trouble than if you're just a Naradama. The next class, three, the next class of Duskriti is called Mayaya Ritagyana, or those persons whose erudite knowledge has been nullified by the influence of illusory material energy. These are your intelligent people. They are mostly very learned fellows, great philosophers, poets, literati, scientists, etc. But the illusory energy misguides them, and therefore they disobey the Supreme Lord. There are a great number of Mayaya Ritagyana at the present moment, even amongst the scholars of the Bhagavad Gita. In the Gita, in plain and simple language, it is stated that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There is none equal to or greater than him. He is mentioned as the father of Brahma, the original father of all human beings. In fact, Sri Krishna is said to be not only the father of Brahma, but also the father of all species of life. He is the root of the impersonal Brahman and Paramatma, the super soul in every living entity is his plenary portion. He is the fountainhead of everything, and everyone is advised to surrender to his lotus feet. And these are all fair statements about Krishna from the Bhagavad Gita. Plain and simple. Despite all these these clear statements, the Maya or the Jnana, deride the personality of the Supreme Lord and consider him merely another human being. They do not know that the blessed form of human life is designed after the eternal and transcendental feature of the Supreme Lord. All the unauthorized interpretations of the Gita by the class of Maya Pratigyana outside the purview of the Parampara system are so many stumbling blocks in the path of spiritual understanding. The deluded interpreters do not surrender unto the lotus feet of Sri Krishna, nor that they teach others to follow this principle. Now see, here's a typical question where, whether somebody's really intelligent or not, or where you see a conflict between so-called material intelligence and actual intelligence. Because if you read the purports, say, of a Mayavadi in the Bhagavad Gita, they use great intelligence to evade the meaning of the text. You know, a whole lot of world jugglery, a whole lot of cleverness to figure out some way to show that this text doesn't mean what it says. Now you've seen that. Everybody's seen that phenomenon. People can do that with a great skill and ability. And yet somehow or other, the stray, plain, poor, honest meaning of the text, they can't see or refuse to see. Now see, that always strikes me as stupidity. Even though they're so intelligent.
People do it with each other too. So
huh?
People do it with each other.
Sure. Yeah.
To avoid communicating.
The last class of Duskriti is called Asuram Bhavam Ashrita, or those of demonic principles. This class is openly atheistic. Some of them argue that the Supreme Lord can never descend upon the material world, but they are unable to give any tangible reasons as to why not. There are others who make him subordinate to the impersonal feature, although the opposite is declared in the Gita. Envious of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the atheist will present a number of illicit incarnations manufactured in the factory of his brain. Such persons whose very principle of life is to decry the personality of Godhead cannot surrender unto the lotus feet of Sri Krishna. So, the difference between the two classes is that the Mayayama Kritagyana, they're educated, learned people are lured by Maya into useless speculation. They want to avoid Krishna, so Maya lures them into useless speculation. These others, this last class, the Asura Bhava Masvita, they hate the very thought of Krishna. They are much more openly hostile. They can't stand the idea. They're atheists, the atheists. Sri Yamunacharya, our Bandaru of South India, said, "O my Lord, you are unknowable to persons involved with atheistic principles, despite your uncommon qualities, features, and activities. Despite your personalities being confirmed by all revealed scriptures in the quality of goodness, and despite your being acknowledged by the famous authorities renowned for their depth of knowledge in the transcendental science and situated in the godly qualities. Therefore, one, grossly foolish persons, two, the lowest of mankind, three, the deluded speculators, and four, the professed atheists, as above mentioned, never surrender unto the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead in spite of all scriptural and authoritative and So there they are. Any questions? Yeah.
So again, it seems like 1, 3, and 4 are subcategories of 2. Because there's 99.9% of the population, not too many people outside mm-hmm. of that category.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Could one be one of the other three without being an Arahatama? Yeah, you could. You could be a Mahayana again without being an Arahatama. Because you could be like a person who's actually interested in spiritual life, but really get shunted off into the Mahayana person. So that's possible. Because the Arahatamas, they are not interested no religion, again. There's no religious principles. So if God gets lost, then also you're an Arahatama automatically.
Activities and causing problems in spiritual life, there must be more activities. No
this natural leaning toward improvement. But when one is further advanced, that is, in knowledge, his knowledge develops further, he can understand that there are activities in the spiritual life and that these activities constitute devotional service. Devotional service are the activities of spiritual life. They are transcendental. Text 19. I'm on page 393. Realizing this, he becomes attached to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and surrenders unto him. Surrenders to him. So now we understand, that's the first line. Now, Vasudeva Sarvamata. At such a time, one can understand that Lord Sri Krishna's mercy is everything, Vasudeva Sarvamata, or his mercy is everything, that he is the cause of all causes, and that this material manifestation is not independent from him. He realizes, this is the devotee, the Jnanavan, the material world to be a perverted reflection of spiritual variegatedness. There's a connection. And realizes that in everything there is a relationship with the Supreme Lord Krishna. This is spiritual realization. Thus he thinks of everything in relationship to Vasudeva. He sees nothing unconnected. Somewhere in the second canto, the Prabhupada's comments in the purport that people want the pantheistic vision, that is, they want to see God everywhere. He said, but to see God everywhere, you have to use everything in God's service. And as soon as we think of something in relationship to sense gratification, we don't see it in relationship to God. As soon as we think of it in the object of potential object of devotional service, and immediately we think of it as relationship to God. So if you want this vision, Vasudeva Sarvam, this connection has to be seen and practically realized by engaging everything, the senses and the sense objects, in the activities of devotional service. Then that realization will come. Krishna will become. You see, Krishna is everything. You'll see everything in relationship to Krishna. So that there's never a sense of being.
It says,
Still coming to you. Prabhupada said there's a...
Huh? Is it still there?
Yeah, I think so. There's a lecture which Prabhupada said in one lecture that he said, don't see a tree, see Krishna. So the material vision is, oh, here's something, a lovely tree I can enjoy, I can sit on in the shade, it's beautiful, it has pretty flowers, I can chop it up into board feet to make some money. I see it like that. Separate from Krishna. The devotee sees this is Krishna's spiritual and material energies. There's a jiva soul, which is my spiritual energy, and then there's a separated material energy, earth, air, fire, water, ether, mind, intelligence, ego, right? All this is described right in the very beginning of this chapter. Well, we should see that both of these energies come from Krishna. And Krishna is also present as the super soul in that tree. So you see that Krishna is the background. And as you become, as we become more Krishna conscious, Krishna becomes obvious. Actually, the existence of God is self-evident. As Prabhupada another time, someone said, we haven't seen God. The Prabhupada said, have you seen the sun? Have you seen the moon? So these are his energies, and he's there. I am the light of the sun. Didn't we see in this very chapter also? There was 15 different ways how to see God. Vasudeva Sarva. It's already been given to us in this chapter. The syllable alone, the Vedic mantras, the strength, the strong ability in man, the austerity of all ascetics and so on, all those things. The heat and fire. All these things are Krishna. Because they're different manifestations of his energy. And so one, and it has Krishna's world, has Krishna's stamp all through it. Sometimes you may go someplace in England or something, some famous manor house of some wealthy person, and it has a stamp, his gardens, his hedges, his woods. You go inside, family crest on all the silver and the plates. Everywhere you go, you think of this person because it's got his stamp on it. So in this way, same way, devotee sees Krishna. They see nothing is different from Krishna, but Krishna is different from everything. It's not simple pantheism that Krishna has become spread out and everything is lost as in his existence. No, these are his energies and he's there. Thus he thinks of everything in relation to Vasudeva or Sri Krishna. Such a universal vision of Vasudeva precipitates one full surrender to the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna as the highest goal.
He was above
his body. He should be down
there. Yes,
this is actually such surrendered great souls are very rare. But then Prabhupada quotes, without giving us English, for the Svetashvatara Upanishad. I couldn't locate the English translation of this verse. It's a famous verse, the Sahasra Shiva. It describes the universal form of the Lord. The person with 1,000 heads, Sahasra Aksha, 1,000 eyes, Sahasra Pa, 1,000 legs.
because all heads, eyes, legs are all his. This is it. This universal form is also known as the external feature of the supersoul. Because just as we say, he's the master of the senses, so all my senses, I don't see without Krishna seeing first, I don't smell without Krishna smelling first, I don't taste without Krishna tasting first, I don't hear without Krishna. So all these senses, they're his senses. So he's the person with a thousand heads, a thousand, because all eyes, all tongues are belong to this one person. It's the universal form. So according to Chandogya Upanishad, in the body of a living being, neither the power to speak, nor the power to see, nor the power to hear, nor the power to think is the prime factor. It is the life, the prana, which is the center of all activities. So this prana gives power to thinking, feeling, etc. Similarly, Lord Vasudeva, the personality of God, is the prime entity in everything. This is the life in our body. Enlightens everything, so Vasudeva enlightens that life and is the prime factor in everything inside us and outside of us, in the same way that the life in the body is the center of all activities. And further, these are not important if not related to the Supreme Lord. They are related to the Supreme Lord, but we made them, tried to make them unrelated by engaging them with sense gratification. Sense gratification is the condition of being unrelated to Krishna. Devotional service is a condition of being related. Actually, even if we're in the condition of sense gratification, we really are related, but we don't know it, and we deny our relationship. Therefore, we're under the control of material nature rather than under the control of the internal goodness. Questions now about this? Suchi?
You said that the universal manifestation was the external.
The universal form is the external feature of the supersoul.
Is that different from saying that the supersoul? I always heard that the supersoul, if you can see it in front of you, was the forehead of Vishnu's form. Is it?
This what?
The forehead of Vishnu's form.
Yeah, that's right. That's how he looked, but his external feature or his manifestation, kind of looking at the supersoul through the permutation and commutation of material nature, then he appears as the universal form. Lord of the thousand. The universal form?
Well, no, the permutation and commutation.
You look at material energy. The first step in God realization for people who are absorbed in material energy is to see the cosmic organism as God. You see the cosmos as a living person or a living organism that is God. Now, in a way, that's a fiction. It's a conceit or an elaborate metaphor. But at the same time, it is the external feature of the supersoul, because just as there's a soul in this body, so the universe has a soul. Nishvatma, Sarvatma, who is Krishna, forehanded Vishnu form, visible directly through the eye of devotion in your heart. But then if you look at it, look at the material nature, and you see the sun, the moon, or his eyes, the wind is his breath, the trees are the hairs in his head, the mountains are his blood bones, the rivers are his veins, the passing ages are his movements, and so on. That's the universal form. That's seeing the whole world is integrated around. Do you mean yes? Okay, I wasn't sure.
Do you have a question?
So, and with this interpretation, we should be able to choose a proper rule by the
Lord. I see how that
works. He's sweet. He realizes that the material world is a bit of a reflection of spiritual value, but very good at this.
Yeah.
He knows that everything it is, and he's sort of thinking of the Supreme Lord Krishna.
Right.
So you just, you know, buy your spot now.
Yeah.
So for this interpretation, you should see the difference faithfully.
Well, you should be able to take the indication of Krishna. So you're reading in relation to Krishna again.
What is it for?
Well, you should do more to find out who your spiritual master is. You should find out who you're getting spiritual knowledge from. You're guiding for the path of devotional service. You should study from all of Prabhupada's books what is a spiritual master, his qualifications. We have a resolution now that was passed by the GBC. We put out a plug for the GBC. Which says that a new devotee, as this applies to your condition, should, for the first 6 months of being in the temple, following the process of chanting and the principles, read, study Prabhupada's books, and chant Srila Prabhupada's prana mantra. So then after 6 months, then that candidate can then, if so desires, that time, after 6 months of just accepting Prabhupada as a Shiksha Guru, can then accept someone as a Diksha Guru and chant that person's prana mantra. And that should go on for another 6 months. That's the resolution that was just passed. The idea is that you're not just walking in a temple and somebody says, that's the guru. But you're supposed to be receiving an education in spiritual life and what is a guru. And then after 6 months, it's to help people who can then apply what you've learned and also try to follow the indication of Krishna, who you're initiating spiritual masters. So study very hard. Because you're ultimately responsible. Yeah.
You know what you were saying about how we see through our senses, through Krishna's senses.
You don't see without Krishna seeing first.
So then I was thinking about a class we did a while ago where you explained the relationship between the super soul and the soul and the subtle body and the gross body, and how that we would not even be able to lift our arm without the super soul, the direction of the super soul. And that still eludes me.
Depending on it. Well, you tell me how you do it. Tell me how you lift your arm.
But it makes me think that then the jiva soul is just like this inert blob that can't do anything.
No, he has desires.
But he
can't. He's an agent, but for the fulfillment of any desires, he needs help. Otherwise, you're sitting on this machine, which is a material nature. It's just like you're in a car, up ahead is the chauffeur. You don't know how to drive. So the chauffeur knows where you want to go. You don't even know how to drive. You don't know the map of the city. You don't know anything. But you just get in, you say, Home James. And similarly, you know, I'm sitting here and I think I want a drink of water. Don't ask me how I do it. My arm goes down. There's so many things that happen and signals are going. People are trying to figure out what goes on, you know, with the brain and the arm and the muscle. But somehow we're like, it is desire. I like a drink of water. Now, thinking about the most incredible complex process goes on, you know, where this happens.
And I didn't do it. I don't know, I couldn't tell you. Have you any idea how that happened? Somebody very smart engineered the whole thing. So I know my limitations. That's Krishna. He's the intelligence that makes this body work and keeps the whole thing going. Otherwise, I have no idea. All I can do is desire. Man proposes, God disposes. Okay? That way you can understand. If you just think about that all the time, you can understand Krishna's there. I mean, you're depending on Krishna all the time. Because you are. Because we get puffed up, we think, Karta. There's another ditti. Karta ditti manyate. We had that verse earlier. Ahankara vibhatma. Befooled by material nature and things. Karta ditti manyate. One thinks, I am the doer. Krishna said, in actuality, these things are carried out by material nature, which is working out in this direction. Other questions? Yes. Well, yeah, I don't think we have enough time now to go on. Let's see. Let's go ahead. Let's do text 20. And this section, now we begin a new section, which is the final section in chapter 7. Now, what happens in this section is very interesting. Having talked about people who come to him, then he talks about the other options, which is worship of the demigods and the mayavadis. Things other people do. And so he discusses, analyzes their psychology. Psychology of the karmis who worship the demigods and the gyanis who are mayavadis. And so therefore who fall short of actually arriving at full transcendental knowledge. So he begins with the Mayavadis, with text 20. It was chanted.
Kamaistaristarita jnana
Prapadyante yadevata
Tamdhyamam hashtaya
surrender anya to other devata demigods tam corresponding niyama regulations astaya following prakritya by nature niyata controlled swaya by their own translation those whose intelligence has been stolen by material desires surrender unto demigods follow the particular rules and regulations of worship according to their own natures. Let's read this together. Those whose intelligence has been stolen by material desires surrender unto the demigods and follow the particular rules and regulations of worship according to their own natures. Now, notice in the previous verse we've been talking about those who have developed jnana, jnani, those who develop transcendental knowledge, here meaning not just maya, but full transcendental knowledge. Now text 20 begins, vritta jnana, deprived of those who are deprived of knowledge. See, it's clear in the Sanskrit and in the word for word, kamais, tais, tair, the GAN. So the connection is a little obvious, more obvious when you look at the Sanskrit. Yes, the word, the running translation, those whose intelligence has been stolen. Avidyagyana, the same word in Sanskrit, gyana, avidyagyana. But before we discuss those who gain knowledge, so here's those who are avidyagyana, whose knowledge has been wiped out. By what? By kamas, by kama, material desires. The Prabhupada says, those who are freed from all material contaminations surrender unto the Supreme Lord and engage in his devotional service. That's what we just heard right about. As long as the material contamination is not completely washed off, they are, by nature, non-devotees. That non-devotee nature will be there as long as there's some material contamination. But even those who have material desires and who resort to the Supreme Lord are not so much attracted by external nature. Because of approaching the right goal, they soon become free from all material lust. Then we talked about the four kinds of people who surrender to Krishna. They have material desires. Right? But it's not so bad because they're not Vrittagana. Those who are need money in distress, they approach Krishna. But here it is rather a different group who approach Anya Devata, other gods. And why do they approach other gods? Kamas, their minds are distorted, their intelligence is distorted or stolen by material desires. So they're worse off, that's what Prabhupada's saying. But even those who have material desires and who resort to the Supreme Lord are not so much attracted by external nature. Because of approaching the right goal, they soon become free from all material lust. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is recommended that whenever one is a pure devotee and is free from all material desires, or is full of material desires, or desires liberation from material contamination, he should in all cases surrender to Vasudeva and worship him. As stated in the Bhagavatam 2.3.10, it's a verse we've been hearing a lot. Kama sarva kama va moksha kama idada bhiti vrena bhakti yogena yajita purusham param. Less intelligent people who have lost their spiritual sense take shelter of demigods for immediate fulfillment of material desires. So notice there's a certain, they want quick results. Let's do it quick and dirty. Quick results, huh? Okay. Let me ask questions when I get to the end, okay?
Could you back on from that?
Yeah.
Are there any gods? Because in my country, these people can worship saints.
Yeah, same sort of
rituals.
Close.
Because they worship, they give food, they offer food to them, and they ask for material.
Very similar system.
Because
people will go to saints for particular things. You got some particular thing you want to go to this saint or that saint. They're specialists in satisfying different desires. And somehow or other you think that they will somehow be more effective, immediately effective than God himself. Right? That psychology is there. Generally, such people do not go to the Supreme Personality of Godhead because they are in the lower modes of nature, ignorance and passion, and therefore worship various demigods. Following the rules and regulations of worship, they are satisfied. The worshippers of demigods are motivated by small desires and do not know how to reach the supreme goal. But a devotee of the Supreme Lord is not misguided. Because in Vedic literature there are recommendations for worshipping different gods for different purposes, for example, a diseased man is recommended to worship the sun. Those who are not devotees of the Lord think that for certain purposes demigods are better than the Supreme Lord. But a pure devotee knows that the Supreme Lord Krishna is the master of all. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi Lila, 5.142, it is said, Ekalai Ishwara Krishna Arasava Vritya. Only the Supreme Personality of Godhead is Krishna, is master. Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, is master, and all others are servants. Therefore, a pure devotee never goes to demigods for satisfaction of his material needs. He depends on the Supreme Lord, and the pure devotee is satisfied with whatever he gives. This purport is worth remembering because it tells us why people worship demigods. Verse and purport. Analyzes because of the Svarupa Jnana, being deprived of knowledge, they approach Anya Devata. It says he followed particular rules of worship according to their own natures, prakritya, that is, as they are controlled by ignorance and passion. This passion and ignorance causes their strong material desires to become deprived of knowledge. And therefore they approach these demigods. They have small desires, and they think that for certain purposes the demigods are better than the Supreme Lord. So any questions about this? This verse.
I've also heard, though, I can't recall, I guess, it was in class, different demigods are listed who worship Christ from different modes.
Yeah, there are also, I've seen that some.
But you are kind of demigods, you know, Sarasvati, you know, and stuff like that.
I'm trying to use this index in these things. In Goodness Modes, page 773. Divisions of Faith, chapter 17. Men in the mode of goodness worship the demigods, those in the mode of passion worship the demons, you're right. And those in the mode of ignorance worship ghosts and spirits. He says, those in goodness worship a particular demigod for a particular purpose. Those in the mode of passion worship demons. He mentions the guy in Calcutta who worshiped Hitler. He made so much money in the black market due to World War II. But since it was the cause of war, one of passionate ignorance select a powerful man to be God. That's where I got that from.
Well, the person's in the mode of passion has got a lot of different desires to feel. And worship demigods too.
So hear what he talks about in the purport. The impersonalists are supposed to be situated in the mode of goodness and they worship five kinds of demigods. This is the Panchopasana system.
He worshiped Brahma, right.
Well, the general thing about Bhagavad Gita is it kind of gives a very general principles. And then sometimes you see in Srimad Bhagavatam how they're clarified, modified. It's like once you go to Krishna's abode, you never fall down. But actually, we know that it's possible. But you can't return. That of all the planets, they're places of suffering. But actually, in Brahmaloka, you find out this. You know, it's pretty nice. Like that. Sometimes you see like that. So here it says, it's talking about Anya Devata, but there's Kama. So there must be some qualification of the mode of goodness, even to follow the rules and regulations of Shastra to worship demigods. So there must be some qualification. So as a general rule, there's some goodness there. But if passion really gets supreme, then they'll end up worshiping the demons. And if ignorance really gets supreme, then they'll worship ghosts and spirits. So, I mean, it's more that there's such different combinations and permutations in the world of nature. So if they worship them because of karma, that has to be because of passion. In that context. In this context, Prabhupada mentions particularly refers to the impersonalists who worship the Panchopasana. So that could be a higher level of demigod worship, but they worship the five, they worship Ganesh, and who do they worship? Ganesh, Lakshmi, Shiva, Surya, and Vishnu. The impersonal, I mean the universal form. Philosophy of Vishnu.
I guess some groups want to sell the mantles like Jim Baker's back. They kind of worship God like in a real any passion by like material meaning. So I guess it's really all kinds of
variation. Yeah, and you see there are like that. There are people like Protestants who don't have saints and demigods. They manage to somehow or other work all this into God, all the same kind of desires. And there are lots of ways of going about it. see what Prabhupada said in other places.
Is worshipped by all sorts of demons.
Yeah, the demons can go through. Let's talk about human beings. They worship Shiva. But then you see, you know, Vitrasura, he wasn't in the mode of goodness at all. Ravana was not in the mode of goodness. So, I don't know, there's some particular context in this chapter. This is particularly talking about the kind of faith that a person requires according to their motives.